Hi everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, the geek show's dedicated to books, arts, culture. Well, we say culture, but we are a podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Andrew.
Hello.
And this time we've replaced Graham with Mick.
Hello.
Yes, technically.
We've traded Graham for a younger, better-looking, smarter, a different model.
I'm glad you're making use of that thesaurus.
Yes. Anyway, we're going to get straight into things because it's cold outside and we need more things to warm us up. So, Andrew, shall we get people heated up first?
Oh, a bit hot and bothered under the collar.
Yes.
Well, I can do that because following last fortnight's show, we now have the winner of the Bad Sex and Fiction Awards. And it was won by Christopher Bolan for The Destroyers.
Wasn't that the one that you started off with in the list?
I think it came partway through. I believe that was the one with avalanche precision in it.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We were questioning how do you have a precise avalanche.
Yeah, which I thought that one certainly wasn't the best. But we've got another quote from the book here, which makes me realise why it's won.
Okay. So,
she covers her breasts with her swimsuit. The rest of her remains so delectably exposed. The skin along her arms and shoulders are different shades of tan, like water stains in a bathtub. We're not at the good bit yet. Her face and vagina are competing for my attention, so I glance down at the billiard rack of my penis and testicles. Incidentally, this week's Literary Loitering is not safe for work. It's the workplace. Oh boy, sorry about that.
Water stains in a bathtub.
It really paints a word picture.
Yeah, you know. Actually, I was going to make some joke about it not making sense, but surely what that means is like, what when you've had a good old bath and the water's like really dirty. Your skin looks like the stained dirty bath water leaves when I try and flush it away. God, and they say romance is dead.
Here, try this Ajax body wash.
you just rub some of that on while I get the billion back.
Oh, God. Is that normal billiards or bar billiards? Sorry, what was that?
I think you get thrown out of the bar if that's the kind of billiards you're playing.
I'm going in off.
Oh, resting on the cushion. And then
bad sex awards. You just keep on giving.
And now Mick knows why we love the Bad Sex Awards so much.
Shall I move on to something good and wholesome?
Yes, yes, please.
That'll make a refreshing change for you.
There's a first time for everything.
Yeah.
So there is a London photographer named Ameya Kulkarni who has released a book of photographs. It's a kind of various pictures from his travels around the world. Lots of animals. You've got some sheep, an elephant, a giraffe. The announcement are literally the most evil creatures on the planet.
The what?
They'll take your hand, Rob. They'll take your hand if you try and touch them.
What will?
The giraffes.
But they're
angry, vicious creatures. Savage monstrosities.
Have you met many giraffes?
I've met one. You know who you are, giraffe. You know what you did. You know what you did.
Isn't that a bit speciesist, Andrew? Tarring all giraffes with the same brush just because you had a bad experience with one.
It's not my fault. It's just that they all look the same to me.
We'll just add that to the many, many lists of ists that you've exhibited on podcasts.
Mainly on Literary Loitering.
Anyway, the point was that the photographer guy, he's 12 years old, and he's made this book to help children with clefts. So see, it's nice. It's nice and happy and good and wholesome. Giraffe.
See, I saw the picture of, was it sheep or goats? I couldn't tell.
I think they're sheep.
Actually, that given what you've just told us about giraffes, Andrew, that would explain why the photograph of the giraffe is taken from the back.
That is a good point. That's another never approach a giraffe head on. They'll see it in your eyes. Yeah. That's when they strap.
They'll wait until they see the whites of your eyes.
I tried to pet the giraffe and it headbutted my hand. It hurt. It had a big bruise on it.
How old were you?
I was maybe 15. Like, I was trying to explain to my sister, don't worry, there's nothing to be afraid of. The giraffe is a friendly creature. I'll admit, on that one occasion, and only then, I was wrong. We all make mistakes. I was trusting giraffes.
It does seem, though, reading more of the article, that this 12-year-old is rather precocious. Because 2 years ago, he also had a photography exhibition that he hosted to raise funds for the victims of the Kashmir floods.
Wow.
Do you sometimes feel like you're maybe not accomplishing all that much with your life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll admit, I've gone off this child.
I blame the parents.
Well, given
I blame my own crippling lack of self-worth.
Mick's just blaming the parents for being good parents who raised him well and gave him all sorts of opportunities.
Yeah.
That's not how parenting works.
Why don't they do what other parents do and, like, you know, make themselves conscious and crush their pioneering spirit?
Yeah, parents. I mean, in their defence, though, that they did, like, break God knows how many health and safety rules in letting him get close to a giraffe.
Yeah.
I mean, that could have been the end of him. I might have got slightly sidetracked with this story.
It's that giraffe trauma coming back to haunt you.
But I think it's important that we establish this podcast as being staunchly anti-giraffe.
I think you've done that.
That is our platform.
No giraffes.
I'm now going to look up what it is that you're suffering from.
It's a little condition called the truth, Mick.
Actually, I do want to know what a fear of giraffes is.
It's camelopardophobia.
I mean, is that a fear of camels as well?
No, it's the ancient name for the giraffe because the
camelopard, yeah.
That's how we should name things. It looks a bit like a camel, but it's got spots like a leopard. It's a camelopard.
That is literally how they used to name things.
Yeah.
Well, look, over down the road, it's a spike mouse.
That is such a cool name. But
that then begs the question, how did they name the elephant an elephant?
Well, they didn't, did they? They called it a pachyderm because it's the Latin name that you're using.
Elephant would be hose horse. It's a hose horse.
Would that not make the rhino a horn horse?
Yes.
Which sounds like a completely different thing.
It does.
Sounds like it belongs in a game of billiards.
Is that a special move in billiards? The horn horse. He's going to go.
You don't want one in the top pocket, that's for sure.
No, he's got a horn horse off the cushion.
Remember when we said this was going to be a wholesome story?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, welcome to Literary Loitering, Mick. This is what happens.
So it's a bit like Four Panel, but more so?
Yes.
Kind of, yeah.
Okay. I'll stop looking for the point immediately, then.
If Four Panel is a bad part of town, then Literary Loitering is that bad part of town's gutter.
Hey, you're crediting us with far too much praise.
Shall I instead credit us with another news story?
Yes.
Okay, good, because there's a new museum coming to Glendale, California. It's dedicated to the history and art of selfies.
I got what?
There's an entire selfie museum coming, set up by Tommy Honton and Tare Mamadov, who are two escape room designers that want to explore the history of the selfie and why people take pictures of themselves.
So what were their names
again? Spoiler alert, it's because they're really vain and self-centered.
Yeah. What were their names again?
Tommy Honton and Tare Mamadov.
I'm sorry, that second one that cannot be a real name. That has to be made up.
That sounds like one of those strange military ranks that crop up in Star Wars.
Exactly.
We're not allowed to say things like that. We come from the country of Benedict Cumberbatch.
This is
we're not associated with other people's names.
No. You've got his name wrong. Remember, it's Emerson Cumberbund.
That's right. I'm terribly sorry. But Emerson Cumberbund is a more normal sounding name, isn't it?
Exactly.
Tare Mamadov, though, I think that's like two ranks below Grand Moff.
Yeah. So does it go Tare?
Tare Mamadov is what happens when you're a Grand Moff and then you die, but you get brought back as a horrifying CGI monstrosity.
Oh, right, yes.
And still turn in one of the best two performances in the movie.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to know, is this selfie museum then? Because I remember the story from a while ago where someone was taking a selfie in a museum and accidentally caused £200,000 worth of damage. Are people in this selfie museum going to be allowed to take selfies?
It's positively encouraged. They've included a fake skyscraper that people can climb for a rooftop selfie, a bathroom selfie area configured as a two-sided room, and an exhibit for the ubiquitous food selfie.
Oh, God.
This is across 8,000 square feet of museum.
Oh, God, I've just realised they're going to do, you know the four-colour Warhol thing of Marilyn Monroe? They're going to do that, but with duck face, aren't they?
Yeah.
To be fair, there's also, like, apparently going to be exhibits about the pitfalls of narcissism and just all the crazy amount of deaths that happen to people taking selfies.
Although,
they've already been done on the Darwin Awards.
But that's not art, Rob.
There is a bit at the end that makes this sound a little bit like The Emperor's New Clothes, though. It's sometimes art is inaccessible. We wanted to create a real space where not only could people see the art, but be a part of it themselves. We basically created a room, lads. Crack on.
That is brilliant. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to open up an entire art gallery. And when people walk in, there's just a single little post-it note saying, you are the art.
Yeah.
I will win all the awards.
Oh, God.
There is the fact, of course, that, you know, one of the key things about the selfie is that it's an of-the-moment event, whereas, you know, a trip to a pop-up museum is a kind of planned thing. This is selfies with forethought. That doesn't really work.
No. I don't know, but I feel like now one of the official crimes should be selfie with malice and forethought.
culpable selfie-taking.
Oh, no. Maybe they should put malice and forethought as filters on Instagram. The malice filter and the forethought filter.
Anyway, shall we move on to our last news story?
Yes.
Yes.
So, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice has, well, kind of been investigated by the Dallas Morning News, and they found some perhaps odd choices when it comes to what books are allowed for inmates.
Okay.
So, kind of on the list of things that you aren't allowed to read in prison, The Color Purple, Freakonomics, Monty Python's Big Red Book.
What?
And others. Oh, yeah. Collection of Shakespeare's Sonnets, Where's Waldo, which is their version of Where's Wally, Santa Spectacular, and Homer Simpson's Little Book of Laziness.
Hang on. These are books that they're not allowed to read?
Yep. Do you know what they are allowed to read, though? Mein Kampf, two books by former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke, Satan's Sorcery Volume 1, and 100 Great Poems of Love and Lust.
Wow. And yet Homer's Little Book of Laziness is banned.
Now, you opened this article by saying that the list was odd. I don't think it is for Texas.
That is true. But also it gets better. It's like the reason a lot of these are banned is not necessarily because of their content. But apparently the Monty Python one is because it's got some naughty bits in it.
Okay.
But a lot of them are banned because it's been found that you can easily smuggle contraband in them.
Okay, so it's a more logical thing then.
Yeah, especially the worst Waldo ones. Gads had never find contraband in those.
Okay, where's Waldo? Is he by the fountain? Is he near the swimming pool? Is he underneath this giant mountain of cocaine?
Yeah, but after that they'll go, there he is, get him, get him. And then just calling on the radios, we found Waldo. Everyone move in.
Also, I feel like there's an irony in like escape tools being smuggled in Homer Simpson's little book of laziness.
Yeah.
So they're not allowed Game of Thrones and Walking Dead because they contain nudity or sexual images, but they are allowed 50 Shades.
I mean, I guess it technically doesn't contain sexual images.
No.
Oh, here's my favourite one. Freakonomics, which I mentioned is banned, has been banned because it contains racial content and has been deemed capable of provoking offender disruption. And yet Mein Kampf isn't.
I like the fact that they specifically say that Mein Kampf is on the approved list because it does not violate our rules. But surely your rules are wrong then.
Oh, Texas.
Yeah, that's like saying, well, we don't have any specific laws about beating a man to death with his own arm. I guess it's okay then, rather than maybe we should make one.
No, they just trust that everybody knows it's wrong to beat the man to death with his own arm.
But it's Texas.
Yes.
That's not the kind of thing you can assume, Rob.
I'm not saying I assume it. I'm saying the Texans assume that that's the case.
Similarly, I think we do live in a world now where we need an official, hey, maybe just don't be a Nazi law.
Yeah.
Like, I think Mitchell and Webb's Are We the Bad Guys sketch should be mandatory viewing in all schools.
Yes. I always found it funny that there was the whole Aryan ideology, but I always wondered what would happen if they ever realised that there were more of the so-called ethnic minorities in the world than the Aryans. I think the so-called ethnic minorities outnumber the Aryans by something like 10 or 15 to every one, isn't it?
So that's a beautiful dream, Rob, that like you can picture a world where the Nazis realise this and go, wait, no, that's the logical flaw in our argument. I guess we better give this whole thing up.
No, I just wonder.
It's like it's back to the drawing board, hands.
I'm just wondering if, on a global scale, they realise that they are the ethnic minority.
I don't think they'd care, because let's face it, it's not based on the soundest of principles.
Yeah, true.
But this is some dark territory we've entered.
Yes, yes, yes. Let's head back to the light with a break.
Okay, good, because say we're out of news.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment.
I accidentally picked, like, the darkest possible one to end on.
That's all right.
Excellent.
The world of comics and manga are much, much more complex than I'll ever know. So tune in to 4Panel on the Geek Show Podcast Network to make that whole world a little less intimidating.
And welcome back to the show. My questionable contributions are done for the day. So now Rob and Mick are going to talk about books and I'm going to take a nap or something.
Okay, well, I am uncovering a fairly weighty volume called The Dark North, or to give it its full title, Fantastic Art and Stories from The Dark North, Volume 1, apparently.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad that someone's finally written a book about where we live.
I think this is a different Dark North.
Is this a further Dark North than our Dark North?
Yes, this is the Dark North, collectively known as Scandaweed.
It's some rubbish. Their son isn't eaten out by...
No, but they can't have everything. So yeah, this collection has a foreword by Clive Barker, and it collects some stories written by Martin Dunnelind, and the artwork is by a variety of artists who are big in the Scandinavian games industry, of all things. And there's a mixture of sort of sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and stories based on Norse mythology. And like all anthologies, you know, some of them are a bit more engaging than others. But I think pretty much this, you know, within the context of sci-fi and fantasy, there's pretty much something to appeal to all tastes. Some of them are written in a sort of verse form. Some of them are just a straight prose short story. The one about the gods is written in sort of like the format of a great saga. And they're all reasonably good. My particular favourite is Archon, which is a twist on the sort of humanity escaping the end of the world trope. And it's got a nice little twist in it. It's a little bit telegraphed, the twist, but not so much that it ruins the story. You've got 6 short stories in here.
Okay.
No, sorry, 5. And there's an afterword by someone who claims to be a spokesperson for the Swedish game industry. I assume from that he means all of it. But the artwork is from people who worked for places like Starbreeze Studios, Paradox Interactive, Resolution, Goodbye Kansas, and Winterstone Games.
I recognise at least some of those names.
Yeah, probably the best known out of those is going to be Starbreeze, who did the Payday series of games.
Yeah.
That's where I recognise the name from.
Yeah. Resolution, they're specialists in VR stuff. And I can't wait to try their VR title, Lake Fishing.
Oh, God. Sorry, I didn't mean this. I didn't mean for that to sound as disparaging as it came out.
But Goodbye Kansas, as in VFX, CGI, motion capture, and 3D animation. But the artwork, again, because it's an anthology and you've got different artists, it's a subjective thing. The stuff you like, you will find stunning. The stuff you don't like, you'll go, meh, it's all right. But it's a personal thing. On the whole, it's a very high standard of artwork that matches the story content really, really well. The story about the gods at the end, it's got Stranger Things feel to the artwork,
okay.
If anything. But yeah, really enjoyable. And it was one of those things, I think it came in and you thought it was going to be a graphic novel because it was shrink-wrapped at the time. So it sort of landed on my lap for possible inclusion on 4-panel, but no, it's not a comic. But it is an enjoyable read. Not light-hearted, as any viewers of Scandinavian drama on telly will probably be familiar with. There aren't a huge number of happy moments in this, but it's still enjoyable and interesting nonetheless.
Okay.
The thickness of the book sort of belies its content. It's just shy of 200 pages, but there's quite a... It's 230 pages, but there's quite a lot of those pages that are just taken up with sumptuous artwork and full-colour landscapes and things. And because of the format of some of the stories, they maybe only take up... In a lot of cases, maybe a quarter of the page is text.
Okay.
So, you know, although it looks like an imposing volume, you could You could probably do the whole thing in maybe two or three sittings. I know I did.
All right, excellent.
And I look forward to volume two.
Awesome, awesome.
Hey, everything worked out.
Yay!
And maybe that's because we deliberately gave you this book instead of accidentally thinking it was a graphic novel. This was the plan all along, Mick.
It was. So, my turn is...
Before he starts to think about how little sense that makes, you say a book.
Yes. I have the third book in the Apollonian Case Files, which is called The Legion Prophecy. And, right. I talked about the first two books, The Lazarus Gate and The Iscariot Sanction. The Legion Prophecy
I was just about to say that.
The Legion Prophecy is set...
I wasn't.
I know you weren't. The Legion Prophecy is set 3 years after the events of the Lazarus Gate, and where the Iscariot Sanction was kind of a prequel, kind of sequel to the Lazarus Gate, this is following directly on from the Lazarus Gate 3 years later. The first two books kind of set the scene, they kind of set up the mythos of the world, and things really start coming together in the Legion Prophecy. The main character of the series has been kind of Captain John Hardwick, who is a former army veteran in the Victorian period. He was held captive for a while as a prisoner of war by Burmese dissidents, and he was released. Nobody knew why, and nobody could explain it, but he then was recruited by the agents of Apollo Lycia, and he became one of their best agents, one of the most trusted ones. He's kind of like Indiana Jones, crossed with Sherlock Holmes, crossed with some former military veteran. So he's a bit more no-nonsense, and he has been going around solving all these problems for the Crown, for Queen and Country, and those problems just happen to involve forces beyond mortal ken, things that can open holes into other realities and various things like that. So it's all been going on behind closed doors. Kind of a Victorian version of The X-Files at times, but with a lot more teeth, I found, especially from this third book. The interesting thing is, the third book has John Hardwick. Actually, he's left the agents of Apollo Lycia. He's become something of a recluse, and he had a massive falling out with one of his closest friends from the first book, Captain Jim Denny, who is now taken over as the most trusted agent of Apollo Lycia. And Jim has been going around trying to fix a problem, because the books introduce this character called The Artist. And the artist's real name is Sun Pen, I think it is, if I remember rightly. Now, he's supposed to be dead, right? He's supposed to be dead, but he seems to be very much alive, and there seems to be all these creatures that are appearing left, right, and centre, and he seems to be at the heart of this, and he turned out to be an enemy of Victorian England, and basically of the human world. So Jim Denny has to try and figure out what's going on. He is aided in this by an American adventuress called Marie Furnival, who he doesn't really know that well and doesn't trust at all, and together they have to try and get John Hardwick back into action, because he's got some connection to this. He, you know, something is tying John Hardwick directly to everything that's going on, and so they have to try and get him to basically put his mind on the case and see what they can dredge up. So that's basically an overview of everything that's going on in The Legion Prophecy. Gotta say, this is probably the best book in the trilogy, in the series so far. I don't know how long this series is going to keep going. Now that they've established the mythos with the first two books, this is where the action really starts going, where, you know, the stakes get raised a lot more. And I found that some of the problems that were affecting the first two books are less of an issue by the third book. It seems like a lot of the kinks have been worked out, especially with all the character introductions being done. You can just, by the third book, if you're going to be getting this book, you've probably read the first two books, so it needs very little in the way of introduction or anything like that. So things can just motor on And it doesn't really go into much detail about things that have happened in the previous books. It does it by extension through conversations with other characters. It's learnt to do a bit more of the show rather than tell, which was one of the problems with the first two books, where it was telling a lot more than it was showing. And so that's one of the good things about it, or one of the better things about it, I should say. The dialogue between the characters is still very well done, but I think one of my main issues is Marie Furnivel doesn't really feel like a character right at the beginning. Kind of feels more like an addendum, an afterthought, a bit like Cyborg in the Justice League movie. Takes a bit of time for her to really come into her own and really be fleshed out as a character. John Hardwick is the same sort of character as he's always been. Jim Denny is actually quite an enjoyable character because he's kind of a little bit John Hardwick, but you remember Ambrose from the first book, Andrew?
I do, from like the half of that book that I've read.
Yeah. Jim Denny's a bit kind of a cross between Ambrose and John Hardwick, so he's a bit more of a rogue than John Hardwick is, but he is just as cunning and ruthless as John Hardwick, but a lot more playful than John Hardwick was. So I kind of like Jim Denny more as a character than I did John Hardwick. I think Jim Denny's more of an interesting character. Him and John had massive falling out, which is why they're not talking to each other right now. You know, like all good manly fallouts between friends who are manly and used to be former military. Although I've got to say that whole falling out bit, it feels a bit like, you know, those playground things when they actually start talking to each other again. It does have that playground vibe to it.
Oh, no. Did Jim steal his dowly snackable?
I don't know. Remember...
Or worth traded him a Pokemon card that wasn't as good as the card he got.
I don't know, but it's just when they start talking... when they start talking to each other, it has that schoolyard vibe when they start talking to each other. It just... You get those overtones of, like, when you were five and you were talking to that friend who did something wrong and you didn't like it, and so you're not talking to them anymore. It's got that little vibe to it. But aside from little oddities like that, little idiosyncrasies like that, I've got to say, Legion Prophecy is actually pretty solid as a read. It's a lot more enjoyable to read it than the first two books were. But again, if the first two books have the job of kind of setting up the mythos of all of this, and if this is going to be a longer series than just the three books, then I'm actually interested in finding out what happens next. I'm actually interested in the further adventures of the Hardwick family in Victorian London. Because this one it's actually been pretty good.
Cool.
And that's about it from the books. So anyway, it's our last show of the year, and what better way to end 2017 than with a quiz so Andrew can reclaim his glory.
That is pressure on it.
Look, let me get this straight. You're going to end the year with a quiz.
Yeah.
On my very first appearance on Literary Loitering.
Yep.
You did that we told you to
can
do.
Can I ask you, Vic? I did, because you didn't tell me to do any.
You don't need to have done any revision for this quiz, Mick. Don't worry.
Okay.
Right.
I suspect Andrew will have done, though.
No, he won't.
You fool. That's not how Andrew rolls.
Right, now.
He guesses the answers and it sometimes works out.
Yes, this is true.
And then he starts talking in the third person and can't stop.
Yeah. So anyway, this is a simple multiple choice quiz. As always, the one with the most points at the end wins. And this one is all about gestures in other cultures. So...
I think of one or two right now.
Exactly. But they may mean something different in a different culture.
Oh, no. You get their meaning.
You'd be surprised. Anyway, starting off with the first one, which of these physical gestures, which is commonly recognized in the Western world as an affirmative, can be found vulgar and offensive in places like Russia, the Middle East, and even parts of Greece? Is it a downward nod, a thumbs up, clapping your hands, or an open smile?
I believe it's the... Do we just shout in with answers here?
Yeah, that would go for thumbs up.
Yeah, me too.
Correct. It is thumbs up.
This is because I've been to the Middle East and was warned not to do it.
That's not fair. You're not allowed to know the answer.
And you were worried, Mick.
What kind of cockamamie quiz is this you think you're part of?
In fairness, Andrew got it right too, and he answered before I did.
Yeah. Right. Open displays of anger are becoming more and more common in many countries, even in
Britain.
No,
they are not.
Yeah. Even in Britain, which is a country known for its emotional restraint. Actions such as pointing aggressively, scrunching your face, and raising your voice will make most people think you're angry. But if you were to display those gestures in Kenya, what are the locals most likely to think? Are they going to think that you're happy, that you're singing, that you're greeting them, or that you're mentally ill?
Well, if it's us three, all of the above.
The action is pointing aggressively, scrunching your face, and raising your voice.
Kind of want to say greeting, maybe?
I think they think I'm happy.
Final answers, yep?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to think you're mentally ill.
Okay.
But I mean, surely the point of being mentally ill is there isn't like a specific... You don't have a, I'm feeling quite mentally ill today gesture.
Apparently Kenya is a weird place. Don't forget, the Queen was born there.
I don't know how much faith I put in this quiz.
No.
And it's not just because I wasn't right.
Or indeed, Rob's grasp of how royal birth works as an effective way of shaping a culture. Is there another cockamamie question in this cockamamie quiz?
Yes, there are several more.
Oh, God, no.
Yes. When taking a picture, you may see people motioning the rabbit ears sign behind another person's head. In countries like Britain, it's done as a harmless, playful prank. But when it's done to a Brazilian man, what are you seen to be suggesting? What are you suggesting if you do that to a Brazilian man? Are you suggesting he's physically unattractive, that he's balding, that he has an adulterous wife, or that he's evil?
I'm going to go with evil.
Yeah, I was going to say, because like, it's like maybe the devil horns or something.
Apparently you're suggesting that he has an adulterous wife. I don't see the logic to that one.
Maybe you're indicating that she's two-timing you.
Possibly.
I don't see the logic of saying, yep, someone's pointing and scrunching up their face. That definitely means they're mentally ill.
Yeah, I have to agree with Andrew here. The logic of the logic query seems to have changed between questions. You don't seem to have got a consistent theme in this quiz.
I didn't write this quiz. That's my defence. Anyway, what act seen as homosexual in westernised countries is a very common sign of friendship in India, Muslim countries, and African countries? Is it two men holding hands, two women eating together, two men kissing, or two men in a car with each other?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say two men kissing.
Andrew?
I guess I would have to say that or the holding hands, because...
You see, the difficult
what
thing
if
here...
What if it's just a car share to work?
You see...
Friends get lunch together.
What
the hell, Western?
The quandary we've got here now is basically you set out a stall here where our only option is to assess the answers to these questions on a 50-50 basis of do we go for the logic or the non-logic?
That's the idea.
We might as well just toss a coin.
Yep.
Now you're getting the idea with these quizzes, Mick.
So, Mick's gone for kissing. Which one are you going for, Andrew?
I mean, I don't want to keep going for the same answer, but I feel like kissing is the right answer.
It's holding hands.
That would explain the strange looks I got while I was out there. And also why I didn't get given that pay rise. And why certain members of the team aren't returning my calls.
You know how a nod is supposed to... It's supposed to be like a yes, an affirmative, yeah? Apparently in Greece, only a downward nod means yes. An upward nod accompanied by a sucking or clicking sound means no. What other gesture in Greece can be used to say yes? Is it taking a bow, clenching your teeth and hissing, clapping frantically, or tilting your head from side to side?
Side to side.
I mean, That one probably makes the most sense, but I absolutely want to go for just clenching your teeth and hissing. like every Warpon in Greece is acting like a really friendly rattlesnake.
Mick takes it in his tilting your head from side to side.
Yes!
Although, I have to say...
I feel like I had to find a point where I don't just say, yeah, I'll go with what Mick's gone for.
Yeah. I did want your answer to be right, though, Andrew.
But, you know, I'm giving myself an extra point for creating a much more idealised world.
Bearing in mind, of course, that we are fairly convinced you're making this crap up.
Nope. I actually knew the answer to that one. Right, one thing which is shared by almost all cultures is the annoyance and inconvenience caused by camera-happy tourists. However, some cultures react to different extremes. In rural Ghana, what was the reaction of the first locals who had their picture taken by explorers? Was it fear? The Ghanaians thought they were trying to steal their souls. They were not too fussed. Hatred? They're apparently very conscious of their appearance. Or shock? No Ghanaians had ever seen a camera before.
I mean, sure.
I want to say they said, oh, have you not gone digital yet?
Surely the not being fussed makes the most sense, because like, if you wouldn't know what a camera is, and someone just like held a strange clicking box towards your face, you'd probably just think that they're a bit funny. You know, the kind of person that points and speaks in a loud voice and scrunches
up their
face.
You probably say, you're lucky you're here, mate. You should see what they do to people like you in Kenya.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm going to go with not fussed.
You going with not fussed as well, Andrew?
I was going with not fussed first.
So both with not fussed. It's actually fear. The Ghanaians thought they were going to try and steal the souls. Anyway, moving on. Number 7. The OK sign made by forming a circle with your thumb and forefinger is generally used by British people and Americans to tell each other that everything is fine. What less than flattering symbol would a Kuwaiti take that gesture to be? Would they think it was a destructive black hole, the evil eye, poverty in life, or their emptiness in love?
I'm going to go with emptiness of love. And also misappropriate it as the title of my next album.
Andrew.
See, I really want it to be like the black hole. I think just I might start saying that as an insult. But I'm pretty sure it's the evil eye.
Andrew's correct. It's the evil eye.
Yeah. I'm just saying the first thing that comes into my head.
It's a horror victory.
I'm just saying the first thing that comes into my head. Just to get this bloody quiz out of the way.
We can end it there if you want. It is a draw at the moment.
Absolutely not. I want to win.
No.
And there's only 3 questions left, so... Giving gifts is a common sign of friendship, love and respect in just about all cultures.
However, in what universe?
What the gift is, though, could carry different meanings. Which gift may be harmless in Britain, but is a symbol of death in China? Is it a silver trophy, jewellery, clocks or pet cats?
Clocks.
A machine gun.
Are you going for your machine gun?
No, I've literally forgot. Like there was cat, clock, jewellery and something else.
A silver trophy.
I mean, silver trophy because China's super competitive.
Mick, scurry, it's clocks.
I know it's clocks, but it's hard to pick different answers when one of them is blatantly right.
Yeah, I know.
This is a bad quiz, Rob.
Again, I didn't write it. Eating habits are viewed very differently by different cultures. At a British dinner table, it would be seen as rude to slurp your food and drink. In which country is slurping a compliment? Is it South Africa, France, Japan, or America?
Japan.
Yeah, it's probably Japan, because the burping is a sign of a good meal.
Yeah, it is Japan. And finally, when both middle and index fingers are held up in the USA, it is seen as representing V for victory, regardless of whether your palm is facing towards or away from you. Well, this one's easy. In the UK, doing it in reverse, is it an insult? To invite you for dinner, to propose to you, or to attempt to sleep with you?
It's an insult.
I mean, I think in some parts of the country, it's probably an attempt to sleep with you.
Possibly, yeah. Ah, well, make one.
It's
that
actually
one.
It's actually taken on a new role. It's now actually the correct answer when someone says, "Do you want to do a quiz?" And by someone, I mean you. You see, quizzes
so this
are something
is the
that
you first do. And last appearance on the show.
And it
unless,
was a quiz.
Unless you can guarantee me a quiz-free episode.
Anyway, that has brought us pretty much to the end of the show.
Did I win?
Yeah, you won.
No, Mick. No, you didn't.
That's all that matters. And if we take one thing from today's episode, it's that winning's what's important. Taking part sucks.
That's Andrew's philosophy all the time. So all we can say about this, Mick, all we can say about that quiz is you are now thinking exactly the same as Andrew when it comes to these quizzes.
Well, no, clearly I'm thinking better than Andrew because I won.
Ooh, that sounds like fighting words, Andrew.
I think I'd be threatened if not for the fact that no one ever wants Nick to be in a podcast again. Because I'm more fun. I bring the comedy that people listen for.
Oh.
It's just an angry old man.
I wasn't till I started getting that quiz.
Fine, Mick. Why don't you go tell about your quiz victory to your grandchildren?
He's not sore about this, is he?
I will tell them about it. I will pepper my war stories with it.
Right, we are at the end of the show. Literary Loudring is part of the Geek Show Podcast Network. All of our shows are available on Audioboom and iTunes. We have a Patreon, which you can find the link to on our website. We also have a YouTube channel.
I want to support it, though. It's a rubbish show, isn't it? Stupid bloody quizzes.
We're at the end of the year as well. This is the last show of 2017. We'll be back in 2018.
And that was our end of year treat, that quiz.
So the show was fine until Mick came on it.
So, yeah, until next year, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew. And he doesn't get to say goodbye. The show is over now.
We'll see you all later.
Bye.
Said you were banned.
I've been banned from better places than this.
That's not very difficult.
What are you going to not go in them?
All I'm going to say, Mick, is that's not very difficult.